all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web, veteransradio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, PuroClean. PuroClean is the paramedics of property damage. It provides water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold removal, biohazard cleanup. It also has a focus on veteran franchisees. You can learn more about them by going to puroclean.com. Well, it's February, which is always a gloomy month, but let's put a little information at your disposal. It is Black History Month, so we're going to do a little focusing on the service and challenges that African Americans face when in the military. So I think we have two good programs. One is an interview talking about Major General Oliver Dillard, who exceeded everybody's expectations in getting his military career lasting as long as it did and achieving what he did. So I think you'll find his meteoric rise and really an incredible career of interest. But we're also going to talk about some of the challenges that exist. And one of them would be with making sure academic admissions to service academies can reflect our nation, that we can have enough African-American cadets or midshipmen so that 30 years later they can become admirals and generals, right? That's sort of the breeding ground for that. So an interesting dialogue there, too. I think you'll find this very interesting. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Colonel Stephen P. Perkins, U.S. Army retired. We're going to talk a little bit about his service, but we're also going to talk with him about his intersection with Major General Oliver W. Dillard, Sr., who's a pretty impressive figure, I think you'll agree, by the time we get done with this. But Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks, Jim. I really appreciate it. It's been a while since I've seen you. I guess we first met back in May of 2023 at the VA clinic dedication, and I was really appreciative of your efforts on that.
Well, Major General Dillard, somebody to talk more about and learn more about. But before we get in there, you've had a long military career and Army civilian career. So that our veteran radio listeners kind of know you're a guy who knows what he's talking about, tell us a little bit about your military and Army civilian career.
Yes, I was commissioned out of Cameron University, which is right there by Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And immediately after coming out of the Guard for almost 2 years as an artillery officer, I became an infantry officer. Did that for about 10 years, including service with the 82nd Airborne Division and the 25th Infantry Division, and then made the transition to military intelligence. I commanded a battalion at Fort Stewart and got a chance to go to Iraq in 2006-2007. But really, the biggest thing for me, in addition to doing a bunch of those things in the Army, was coming out and being a civilian. And using those skills that I had acquired over the course of 28 years and going into a civilian service that I didn't know exactly what I was getting into, but it was one of those things of we immediately made the transition from Fort McPherson, Georgia, in the Atlanta area, to Fort Bragg / Fort Liberty here in North Carolina. It was during that time period that I first really discovered General Dillard, even though he was an infantry officer, kind of turned MI officer, and immediately, you know, my ears perked that, hey, this was an opportunity to do something for our first G2 here at FORCECOM, or Forces Command.
So I'm going to stop you there on a couple of things, because we got listeners who are not as familiar with the lingo. So tell us what the you transferred into the Military Intelligence Corps, and I know there would be plenty of people who would make a joke at this point about that being an oxymoron, but tell us what military intelligence is about.
Yeah, pretty much in my case, it was to be a tactical intelligence officer, meaning that I would find out about the enemy, analyze it, and give it to my commander as he made decisions. In my case, I also became a counterintelligence officer, and so it was one of those things of, I won't say we're the James Bonds of the military, but we're people that go out and use information gathered from other sources about the adversary and bring it back to our commanders. So really it's just a matter of, in my case, I had a busted knee as an infantry officer, and I said, well, you know, I probably need a couple of skills before I retire. And so I went in and I was intrigued by the intelligence field, and they gave me an opportunity to do that.
Well, I would also point out to our listeners that Colonel Perkins picked up his master's degree in strategic studies from the U.S. Army War College back in 2001. So both experienced and educated in this general area. I want to get another thing out of the way here before you go on and tell a story about General Dillard, and that is, you mentioned the term G2. So explain to the listeners what is the G2 designation in the Army.
Yeah, G2s are essentially go back to the Napoleonic era, to where Napoleon had gave numbers to the various skills or offices that he had on his staff. So G1s being personnel, G3s being operations, and G4s being logistics. So G2 is the intel or intelligence and security aspects of a staff. So that person is actually trained. Sometimes it's an inherent thing, which is kind of the way it was for General Dillard in the beginning. So S2s or G2s, depending upon what level of staff. So generals get a G2. The other guys just get S2s. But that was really General Dillard's first exposure to a staff, was he was the S2 for a battalion in Korea.
Well, let's go back now and transition this to talking about Major General Oliver Dillard, who was born in 1926 in Alabama. But tell us about his education and how he found himself in the military.
Well, he's an interesting character in that he comes from a really poor background, but not one that didn't appreciate education. So he came out of high school, out of high school at about the age of 16, and went to Tuskegee Institute. And so around that same time, the war started, and he was really too young. So he goes to college, and as he starts to turn 18, well, they start looking at him being drafted. And so he puts in a deferment, and they accept it. The next year, however, with 1945, he doesn't think he's past the age of getting into the military and the draft. He doesn't know anything about the draft. And as a young black or African American student, he's not sure what that whole thing is in the military, but he goes through it, and even though he's in RTC at Tuskegee, he goes through the process, and the Army says, no, we want you, and he goes, well, the war's already over in Europe, and they had other things for him to do, like the occupation of Europe after the war. So he gets in there, sneaks in before 1946, which is really essentially when the war ends in Europe, and gets pushed over as a in an artillery unit in Europe. So during that time period, he goes through, he gets identified by a white officer and pushed into OCS. So that's really the first time that he gets so he's got 3 years of college. He's in the unit, comes out of OCS, goes through the Korean War, and then gets a chance to finish his degree while he's at Commanding General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And ultimately, his education ends formally when he goes through the National War College in Fort McNair, District of Columbia, and is dual student, if you will, at the George Washington University. And so that's kind of his education background.
And what's really sort of unique and here that people ought to make sure they're catching is he starts out as an enlisted guy.
He does.
His skill set is recognized. He's encouraged, or I think you said pushed, into going to officer candidate school so that he can move from enlisted to an officer, which normally would have required that degree. They get him through OCS. They get him through making sure he picks up his degree. And now he's on a whole different path, isn't he?
He is. And he's only one of the three black students in the Command General Staff College. Immediately following that, he goes to the University of Omaha, now Nebraska Omaha, in like a special program for people like him. Nowadays, we actually don't let them go that deep. They have to basically get it before their degree before they are captains. And so he's already a major at that time, but he's being recognized as being a fast mover, if you will, at the time. And this is really, he was in when he went to Korea back in 50-51, he was in a segregated unit. So now we fast forward to basically the CGSC class of 58, and he's now one of only three students in that whole class that are, lack of a better term today, a person of color, that are making it through that course. So the Army is definitely starting to identify him, and he's a person at that point with a Silver Star and a CIB, Combat Infantryman's Badge. So he is being looked on as being a fast mover, if you will, but he's in a position where there aren't a lot of black soldiers or officers. One, there aren't a lot of black soldiers, but there are definitely not a lot of black officers. And so he's fighting upstream, but being helped along the way because he's showing some potential and competency.
Well, it's more than potential. It was right. I mean, he really was a very competent officer. And fortunately, our Army recognizes this. Tell us about how he moved over to military intelligence, which brings us back to, that's not an oxymoron. So tell us how that move occurred.
You can't let that one die, can you?
I can't. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Back in his day, we really didn't have a military intelligence branch. So you could be an infantry officer, but also be what we'll call an intelligence officer, just to keep us from having the oxymoron come in. But you could do both. And in my day, there were only, when I made the transition, there were only, they still had the program, which was kind of like a dual branch, but you could be what was called an 1135, which is infantry intel. And when I came in, they quit doing that. They'd quit that. But my first boss, believe it or not, was an infantry officer. My first intelligence supervisor was an infantry officer with an intel background. And what really made it so hard was that you had to know all of these things intel-wise, but you were constantly going back and being an infantryman. Now, the good side to that is that you never quit being an infantryman, and so you were able to give that perspective of an infantry officer to intel people. And General Dillard was famous for his view that we need to get people out of the suits and into the boots. And he jokingly said that, but he was serious about it, that there were a bunch of people that believed counterintelligence people just needed to be in suits walking around looking cool and whatever. And his answer was, no, you need to be in these boots and being relevant to the tactical soldier. So not strategic focus, but tactical focus.
And again, he sort of had this unique perspective because he started over on the enlisted side, artillery in Europe, before kind of moving in a different direction. And one of the sort of, sometimes there's life's a circle. He ends up as the first black deputy chief of staff intelligence for the U.S. Army Europe. He couldn't have imagined that when he went over there in, say, 1946 or 7.
Jim, I can't imagine that today, that you could take an infantry officer and basically put him into a two-star billet of a organization that is in charge of all the land forces in Europe during the Cold War. Did I mention during the Cold War? So we're ready to go to war at any time. This is not, Vietnam's done, and we've now, the whole focus of the U.S. Army is on Europe. And he is the lead intel guy. I can't even imagine how tough that is and the scrutiny that he's being put under because he's not a true blood MI officer.
Yeah, well, and again, and this is so much of life in general, just not the Army, but, you know, he didn't go to West Point. It's not a ring knocker, right? He's African-American, so he doesn't fit in that regards. He went to Tuskegee Institute, which has a huge reputation more on the Air Force side, the Army Air Corps side, than it does in the regular Army side. So just a whole lot of different pathways that got him into all of these first. Do you want to talk to us about some of the first that he's kind of broke the glass on?
Well, I'm not sure I can remember all the first that he did. I will say this. He was only the fifth general officer when he pinned on his star. So there's not a lot of precedence for this. And you hit on a key point that he wasn't the typical guy. And we talked, you talked about not being a ring knocker. He's not even that. He's a Mustang, or what some call a Mustang, which is an OCS guy. So most of the OCS guys don't get an opportunity to make it as far as he did. And I guess the biggest thing that he was the first on was he was the first officer to attend the National War College in D.C. And that was go ahead.
Well, I have from his introduction to the Michigan Military and Veterans Hall of Honor, another little paragraph I'll read, which says, General Dillard served as the first black general officer in the office of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, the last J-2 for the U.S. Military Assistance Command in Vietnam, the first U.S. Army Forces Command Deputy Chief of Staff Intelligence, and the first black Deputy Chief of Staff Intelligence for the U.S. Army Europe, prior, all that prior to, obviously, to his retirement from the Army in 1980. I mean, along the way, there are a whole lot of firsts, aren't there?
You know, they really are. And the funny thing is, as I was researching even more into General Dillard, you brought up the point of where he's the final military assistance command Vietnam J2, meaning the Joint Staff General Officer Command, the guys that are in charge of all of Vietnam. He didn't go there during that tour to be the intel officer. He had gone back to being the infantry guy again, and so he was the deputy chief of staff for the CORDS program, which is basically the civilian advisory and development program in Vietnam. It was only to the point of we were about to get out of Vietnam, and so the J2, he left. The war's not even over, and this guy leaves. And so they're going, okay, well, we need a strong intel guy. Didn't Ollie? Isn't he an intel guy?
Yeah, we give it to him? Yeah.
And so they walked over and said, hey, Ollie, do you want to do this? And he thinks about it a little bit. And remembering that, you know, some of the – he's got about, I think, four things that he tries to think of in life. Part of it, one of his final ones is seize opportunities when you have the ability to seize opportunities.
Wow, isn't that a pearl of wisdom that needs to be passed down to everybody? This isn't a job he was looking for. Not even sure it was a job that he wanted, but it was an opportunity, and you kind of have to grab the bull by the horns, don't you?
You do, and beyond even that, Jim, you have to be ready to do that. So he's preparing, he's thinking about these things all during that time period. So he's already had a 2-year tour being a provincial military advisor up there in Kantun province with General Nguyen. Nguyen Hap Duan is the guy's name, the last mayor of Saigon. And these guys have gotten along really well, and he's really made his name. Ollie's made his name up there in that province of how they have, his advisory team has really done a good job of working with the people. And he's got those kind of tentacles, if you will, that he can kind of pull from, but big time that he recognized opportunity.
Well, you have to be ready for the opportunity. You have to have the skill set, the communication, the analytical thinking. He's demonstrated all of that at that point. And we're talking to Colonel Stephen Perkins, U.S. Army retired. He helped Major General Oliver Dillard write his book, Little Old War Stories, and Steve has authored a number of articles on General Dillard's career, including The Forgotten Sable Officer, which was published in the Military Intelligence and Professional Journal. You are, if you will, Steve, and the family views you this way, as sort of the official biographer for Major General Oliver Dillard. How'd you find yourself in that role?
Well, it was because him being the first general officer, or the first intel guy, G2, at Forces Command. So I had just taken over, and we had a new building at Fort Liberty, Fort Bragg. And so we started naming conference rooms. We had about 3 conference rooms that we were going to try to name after people. And so as we did that, they said, well, you can't name after people. I went, okay.
Oh. There's a rule.
Right. And so I said, that's fine. And then I thought to myself, well, what campaigns, because we're going to make, you had to name them after campaigns. I said, what campaigns was General Dillard in? So the first one, which is really when he made the transition, was the UN defensive campaign of the Korean War. And so that's what we did, was we named the the conference room after him. And I immediately started thinking, what are the things that I can do? And the reason that I called the first article that we had in the Military Intelligence Professional Bulletin, or MIPB, the reason I wrote about it, and it's entitled The Sable Officer, is I had pulled from a guy, his PhD thesis was in, was talking about general officers that had made something of themselves. And he talks about the reason he chooses instead of black is he said he goes with sable. And the reason is that he says, well, people come in all kinds of colors, and sable is, it has multi colors. And so that was how he did it. And I went after the title and I said, you know, he is the, to me, he was the, from an MI standpoint, an intelligence standpoint, he was the quintessential perfect person to show how people have grown since 1951, 53 probably is when they really got rid of segregation, but how we had really grown as a military and had taken a look, had kind of grown as an organization or as an institution. And so he was the first, and so I decided that he was going to be the guy that I was going to put a lot of time and effort into.
Well, he certainly deserves it because his career is phenomenal. The more you look into it, the more you recognize it. But it's been recognized by others. He was awarded the Military Intelligence Corps Association's Lieutenant Colonel Knowlton Award for Excellence in Intelligence. He was inducted into the Officer Candidate School Hall of Fame, the Army Military Intelligence Hall of Fame, the Alabama Military Hall of Honor, the Michigan Military and Veterans Hall of Honor, most recently. The VA named its community clinic in Canton, Michigan, in his honor.
He was also put into the Army's Military Intelligence Hall of Fame.
I mean, these are all outside recognitions of what a tremendous man he was, officer, leader, across a whole variety of times and circumstances. As we close out here, Colonel Perkins, give us your kind of overall thoughts of how Major General Dillard's life should be remembered.
He's really a guy that took on a lot of challenges that, and I use this, the dedication of the Canton facility, I use that he was our hero. And he put a lot of effort into being an honorable person with humility. He always pushed himself and others to be excellent in what he did. Many say that you can't lead unless people know that you care. And he spent a lot of time gaining their respect. But more importantly, because that is really important, right? He seized opportunities, but he was able to really push the envelope on those opportunities because he was competent and ready to do the mission that people were going to offer to him. And again, I just think that as a former Buffalo soldier, and I had actually, I'm not sure if this resonated with you or not, but there was another, although you mentioned like five or six other firsts, I'm going to give you another first. Some believe that that his platoon in Korea was the first American victory on the peninsula during that war. The Battle of Yeochon in South Korea, and his platoon went in, and he was very humble as he described it, but his company commander who was a Buffalo soldier and a paratrooper during World War II, black paratrooper during World War II with the Triple Nickel Regiment. He was there was an article on this battle written for Infantry Magazine, I believe, where he describes all the goodness that Oliver Dillard did. And part of that eventually led to earning the Silver Star. So definitely still my hero. And I hope it's everybody else will read about him and understand. He's got a Wikipedia page, which he was very proud of. And
well, yeah, this is why we tell these stories, is so that we whet your appetite. And maybe you go do some more reading or research on them, and learn more and see the attributes, the talents, the pearls of wisdom in his life, and apply it to yours. And Colonel Stephen Perkins, U.S. Army retired official biographer, if you will, for Major General Oliver Dillard. I don't think there's any pay that goes with that, but at least it's a title, Steve.
Haven't seen any.
I want to thank you for the time that you've given us today on Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks, Jim, and I really appreciate everybody else listening to it, and you specifically of pulling out all, even more that I know of, but may not have been able to articulate earlier than that. So thank you again for your assistance in getting me to open up even more about my hero.
We enjoyed it. Well, General Dillard is a heck of a patriot, broke a lot of barriers. Really, the African community, African-American community, should be very proud of this man and what he accomplished. So we're glad to bring that back to you. As I mentioned at the outset, it's Black History Month. And maybe you've seen or heard about a Netflix film by Tyler Perry that's out called The 6888. It's about a U.S. Army postal unit made up of African-American women in World War II who go to England and then France, and an administrative task of getting piles and piles and piles of mail that was stuck out, as their motto was, no mail, low morale. And they really did accomplish something. It's a great movie. And a couple of years ago, here on Veterans Radio, we did a podcast on the 6888. So you can go search for that, Veterans Radio 6888. Kai Anderson was the author that we talked to. So we were a couple of years ahead of Hollywood, but they're doing a great job of promoting this. We want to bring you a few words from sponsors, and then we're going to talk about Academy admissions.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We're talking today on Veterans Radio with Captain John P. Cordell, retired from the U.S. Navy, and Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green, retired from the U.S. Navy as well. Both gentlemen we've talked to a number of different times on important subjects, but they recently wrote an article that focuses on a subject we've had some passing discussion on, but I want to have some more, which is the tragedy of the lost generation. And that's about the lack of representation of minorities, African Americans, in the United States Naval Academy. It percentage wise, I think, John, you were telling me that while the Navy overall has a 17% black census, the Naval Academy only has about 6%. Is that right?
Right. I recently looked up their demographics of the class of 2024, and it's about 6.8%. Now, the numbers get a little fuzzy because some people identify with multiple ethnic groups. You know, mother was black, father was white. And, you know, as we were talking about the past with folks applying, General Williams reminded me that, hey, back in the day, if you had the option to not put black when you knew that nobody could look you up on the internet or interview you in person, you didn't put black, you put white. And so the numbers may be skewed a little bit, but that's what they said, about 6.8% black midshipmen.
And you referenced a book that I think we ought to give a little mention to, which is Blue and Gold and Black, Racial Integration of the U.S. Naval Academy by historian Robert Schneller.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
When I read your article and looked at his writing, and it sort of, you know, it, when you say it out loud, it makes sense. There are certainly states that because appointments are made by senators and congressmen and women, there are certain areas of the country that have just avoided nominating to the academies a diverse racial population. Was this something that just was obvious and I just never thought about it?
Not at all. So the path to that was through actually the Navy History and Heritage Command, a friend of ours named Denise Krepp, who actually advocated for the renaming of a base that was named for one of her ancestors because he was a Confederate. She actually pointed me towards the Naval Academy archivist, who basically sent me a database, and we got permission to use it, and essentially of all the nominations from all of the Naval Academy going back as far as digital records, which was 1978. And then we basically searched through that data and sorted by state, and then we looked at the demographics of the state and said, okay, are the demographics of the state, you know, the percent black population represented by the percent of nominations. And when you sort that those two columns, magically, all 12 southern states percolate to the bottom with the worst ratio, with Mississippi with the absolute worst ratio. No, it was not readily apparent. And nobody else that I've talked to had even looked at it. So that was kind of mind-boggling to discover.
And Keith, talk a little bit about why it's important that the academies, not just the Naval, but we're focusing on the Naval Academy, that the military academies kind of reflect our general population in terms of who gets into these prestigious positions.
Well, during the Vietnam War, the number one complaint of black sailors was that they had no black officers to go to to share their concerns with. And the Navy and Army took very different approaches on that. The Army banned the Confederate flag in theater in the Vietnam War, and powerful people like Mississippi Senator John C. Stennis pressured the Army to reverse that ban. You had KKK rallies, cross burnings, et cetera, et cetera. You would go into your commander's office and he'd have a big giant Confederate flag on the wall behind him sitting in the in his office in Vietnam. So because there were so few black officers, black people felt like they weren't being heard, they weren't being respected, and they weren't being treated fairly. And all the statistics bear that out. Fast forward to today, you've got all these claims of DEI hires and color over merit, when they don't even understand the history of how we got to the limited number of black officers that exist right now. It is important, if you're going to have a diverse force, that they have people that look like them and represent them. One of the biggest problems in the military justice system is that there are very few black judge advocate general officers. And many of the issues that are treated as disciplinary issues are actually cultural and communications issues. And when you've got someone that has racial bias and they are trying to communicate with someone that is experiencing racial bias, you're setting yourself up for failure. I don't want to see the military go back into a period where you're having this racial strife because you've got a majority white leadership leading a very diverse force, and they have no skin in the game in terms of changing the, you know, that dynamic. But the black people and the minorities, Jewish, black, you know, Hispanic, et cetera, they know what they're experiencing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations where if you, and I think that was language you used, John. If you don't start out as an admiral, you got to work your way up from being an ensign. And if you're not coming out of an academy with a bunch of ensigns who are in the minority classifications, they're not gonna, by attrition and everything else over 30 years, they're not gonna be there in the flag ranks, are they?
Right. Yeah, that number never gets bigger, right? It can only start where it starts and then start to work its way down as you attrite. And that's, you know, but back to Keith's, you know, one of the big counter arguments that I see, and there was a recent article in the Naval Institute making this argument that you know, we're sort of post-racism now, and that we need to focus on meritocracy, and that the military should be a pure meritocracy. And I fully agree that your advancement should be based on merit. But one of the purposes, and Keith can probably articulate this better than I can, of affirmative action was to try to close that gap between opportunity, whether it was wealth opportunity, education opportunity, it was a racial gap, and at least give people who had not had those opportunities a leg up so they could compete in a meritocracy on an equal basis. But you can't have a meritocracy if I can't get in the door in the first place.
Well, and you point out from the statistics, it's sort of a quiet, we just won't make any appointments, or a limited number of appointments. It's a very subtle and quiet bias. Keith, react if you would.
Well, in addition to that, about a few years ago, I did an interview with Steve Walsh at KPBS, and the article was why there's so few black admirals in the U.S. Navy. And Admiral Sinclair Harris talked about the Death Valley phase of a black officer's career. After about 10 or 12 years, when they've been fighting this perception of lack of qualification and subtle racial discrimination and open racial discrimination, they finally decide that they're just not willing to do it anymore and throw in the towel. And then those people are taken out of the selection pool for some of the most motivated people decide that I can't do this anymore, I'm not going to do this anymore, and go get a job in the civilian community. And then they get blamed for not being able to hack it or not willing to hack it when they're competing against people that have not had in any way, shape, or form to deal with those issues. I left the Navy at 22 years because I simply could not take the discrimination I was facing from my commanding officer, who asked me when I challenged him on why he was mistreating me. He smirked at me and said, "Do you feel like a second-class citizen?" And he was completely protected by the people when I filed a five-page discrimination complaint against him, a rock-solid, thoroughly documented case, and he was protected and went on to abuse a ship full of people before he retired as a Navy captain.
Well, we're having this discussion about admissions to the academies, in part because the U.S. Supreme Court in the last year struck down race-conscious admissions at civilian schools, and that raised a question of, well, can race or gender be used in a qualifying applications to the academies? And there are many groups who are filing briefs and motions and saying, yeah, you've got to be able to use these factors if we're going to have the right officer corps going forward. And I know earlier in the year I spoke to the National Association of Black Women Veterans, and it was one of the major issues for that group that they were advocating for. If this is not improved, do you see, John, based on the statistics you ran, are the southern states going to continue what they're doing? Can California make up the difference? New York? How do the statistics tell you this will all work itself out?
Well, you know, when you draw two dots on the board, they lead to a line, and you can follow that line. And so if you do away with the ability to at least consider race, you know, the numbers aren't going to go up. The other two points I would make, Jim. Number one, no one records the number of nominees who were not accepted. And so we don't even know how many applications there were by any sort of demographic means. and what percentage were rejected, whether it was, you know, white, black, Hispanic.
And, you know, let me just give you an example of why this is important. When the first black Secretary of the Army, Clifford Alexander, received a promotion list for one-star general, there were no black people on the list. And he rejected the list. He said, "You can't tell me that there's not one black colonel in the entire United States Army that is not ready and capable of being promoted and has not earned it." So he sent the list back and said, "Go back and look at your top black candidates." And when they returned the list to him, the name of Colin Powell had been added to that list. Colin Powell was preparing to retire as a colonel. His career was over. And then all of a sudden, he gets a new lease on life because the black Secretary of the Army knew that they needed to have a more diversified Army Corps. So imagine how many times that has happened since then, particularly in the Navy, where these very highly qualified black people have been looked over because they're not part of the same group as the rest of the people being considered.
It's a great example, and as I think most people know, Colin Powell didn't go to the academy. He got his commission through an ROTC scholarship. Again, kind of highlights he probably would never have gotten an appointment back in that point in time, and we really need to encourage the representative grouping of folks who get appointments to our academies to reflect the diversity of our country. There certainly are folks who have plenty of skills for it, but if you keep rejecting people, then at the same time, they're not going to apply. They're going to go, as you're saying, Keith, "Hey, I don't have a shot at this. Why am I even bothering?" Right?
That's correct.
Well, it's an important issue, and it's one that folks certainly need to think about and work on, and hopefully our congressional and senatorial staffers who really do the grunt work in getting academy appointments pulled together and the interviewing committees will approach this with a little bit of 2024 insight and not exclude people because of their race, ethnicity, gender. Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green, U.S. Navy retired. As always, Keith, great to talk to you. Keep us informed as these things move forward. And if the Veterans Radio audience can provide any assistance, please feel free to reach out.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Well, we hope that both of these interviews have given you some new information, been a little thought-provoking. We all, in February of every year, we do try to focus on African-American servicemen and women. You know, it is, you know, if you're not taught the history, if you don't know the history of our country and all of the cultures in it, it's easy to kind of think, well, those guys haven't pulled their weight. And that nothing could be further from the truth, from African-American women who joined in World War II and are now, you know, remembered in that Netflix video 6888 by Tyler Perry, which will probably get the word out more about what African-American women did during that war than anything else. Nobody reads the books anymore, so I think that film will be very useful. As I said, we've done a podcast on it you can go listen to. But maybe you also didn't know that of the 3,525 medals of honor that have been awarded as of January 2025, 97 have been awarded to African Americans. And actually, Robert Augustus Sweeney is one of 19 men and the only African American to have been awarded two medals of honors. So, you know, the contributions of our fellow Americans is, you can find it imprinted on in the stories of Medal of Honor recipients. Certainly there were times when the bias and prejudice kept African Americans out of receiving those awards, and in fact there was a time where no Medals of Honors had been awarded to black soldiers who served in World War II. There was a review of files, and several African Americans who had received the Distinguished Service Cross got upgraded to the Medal of Honor back in 1997. So Bill Clinton actually awarded the Medal of Honor to seven African American World War II veterans but only one was alive at that point. So it becomes one of these things where, yeah, there's recognition, maybe there's even recognition of upgrades of metals, but some of that's just a little bit too late to really make a big difference. One of the last African Americans to receive the Medal of Honor was Elwin Cash, Army Sergeant First Class, for activity in Iraq in October of 2005, where he distinguished himself by acts of gallantry above and beyond the call of duty while serving in Iraq in October, as I said, of 2005. So the service of these great men and women who have African-American designation, if you will, continues on and will continue on. They are certainly part of the backbone of the U.S. Army and the backbone of the U.S. military. I mentioned earlier an interview that we did with the National Association of Black Military Women, which I'd point you back to. We did that last year, so you can look that up as well. The National Association website is nabmw.org, a dynamic group of black military women preserving history and helping it continue on the service of other black women. So you may want to look that up as well as you learn a little bit more about these contributions. Would remind you again that our guest, Lieutenant Commander Reuben Keith Green, has a book that you can obtain, Black Officer, White Navy. Very insightful, gives you a different view of what it is to be a black officer in the U.S. Navy. You know, this is recent history, not many, many years ago. So you can look that one up. He's writes on this subject regularly, as does Captain John Cordell. Both gentlemen have a lot of social media presence, a lot of articles. They don't let much grass grow under their feet, advocating for issues that they really do care about. We're at an interesting time in our history as we change presidents and administrations with more focus on rebuilding the military, rebuilding the Navy in particular to respond to the China threat. And, you know, when you look at our you can't rebuild any of the military without adding more people, right? More tanks, more planes, more ships aren't going to make the difference. You got to have the individuals maintaining, driving, all of those sorts of things. Currently, about 29% of the U.S. military are African-American men, and about 17% are African-American women. That is really a big group and critical to our national defense, as is the Hispanic population, which is about 21% of the military men and 18% of military women. So as we think about these issues, as we go into the new organizational administration, new Secretary of Defense, who just got confirmed, who claims he's for the warfighters, we've got to remember our warfighters include blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans, and be respectful and give equal opportunity based on merit to all of those people if we're going to have truly a representative military and one that can protect the entire population. These are important subjects that we bring forward to you on Veterans Radio every week. We want to thank our sponsors, such as the National Vietnam Veterans of America Association, locally VFW Charles S. Kettles Chapter, VFW Graf O'Hara Chapter, and the American Legion Irwin Presscorn Post, all three of those in Ann Arbor. We can't do this without sponsors and supporters. Certainly the Ann Arbor healthcare system, the VA system, the NVBDC, Legal Help for Veterans, all of these folks are important. But we need your help as well. If you can, go to veteransradio.org, hit the donate button, and send us some contributions, some funds. Keep us on the air. It's now been 21, 22 years, and It gets more complicated and expensive every year, so we could really use your support. If you have ideas on people we should talk to, stories you haven't heard, send us a note, jim@veteransradio.org or dale@veteransradio.org. We're always looking for ideas on how to make the program better and get more information out to folks like you who are interested in the U.S. military. Maybe you're a veteran, maybe you're a friend, maybe you're just somebody who understands the importance or just likes history. Obviously, we bring a lot of history to the table, stories that you probably haven't heard somewhere else. So that's where we're at. We're glad to have you on board. Dale will be back next week with more interesting stories. As I said at the outset, I am Jim Fossone. I was the officer of the deck today. Glad to bring you these stories. Hopefully they're a little thought-provoking and maybe something that new that you didn't know about. And if you're out there influencing young men and women to join up, please do so. And if you can influence the right type of kids to join and seek appointments to the military categories, that's what we need. Don't let people get turned away because they don't think they can pull it off. They don't have the connections. Let's get good pools into these academies so that 30 years later, we've got a good core of people that you can make admirals and captains and generals and really leadership in the military. And as we now look at the new Secretary of Defense, I guess you can say you can start anywhere and end up at the top. It's a real good example maybe of that for kids. So I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to bring you these stories today. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.